first. Well, I'm leaving on the 21st. I'll be here on the 20th. Thank you. A few introductory remarks. First of all, thank you to the Primster Institute for letting me be here. It's a great privilege, and I'm deriving great benefit personally from my stay here. And thank you guys for showing up. I was going to thank them too, but it's premature apparently. okay, this paper is based or provoked by two things. I heard a very interesting talk in June by Frank Lalloway at a conference in Vienna on new foundations of physics, which introduced me to his work, which really got under my skin, and I've been thinking about it since. And my ability to be there, I have to thank, for my ability to be there, I have to thank the Institute of Quantum Optics and Quantum Information in Vienna, and also the Templeton Foundation, which paid my registration fee for the conference. So that's the first provocation. The second provocation was an invitation to contribute to a special issue of Foundations of Physics on reduction and emergence. And it seemed to me on reflection that this would be an excellent topic to address from the point of view of reduction and emergence in physics. Now, I've got to stress that my ideas on this are very much in flux. I've only been thinking about it since hearing Frank Lalloway's paper in June. And the deeper in I get, the more I feel like I'm out of my depth because of the fascinating number of physics papers published on related topics in the past 10 or 15 years. In particular, even since coming here, I've learned a lot from Rob and his co-workers on reference frames, which seem to me now to be quite directly relevant to what I'm going to be talking about today. I haven't quite processed this new information. I'm sure that if I were going to write this paper again now, it would come out differently. It's already a preprint in the archive. So what I'm going to do, rather than presenting you with a moving target, is just to give you the main ideas of that paper and see what I can provoke from you. It'll help me to go forward and perhaps integrate some of the ideas I've been hearing from Rob on reference frames. Okay. Now, in any case, this talk is very much intended to stimulate your interest in some underexplored conceptual issues that arise when one applies quantum mechanics to a condensed matter system. I say underexplored, that's particularly the case for philosophers of science. I think physicists have really chewed this one over quite a bit. I looked up on the Pittsburgh Philosophy of Science Archive under the keywords condensate, Bose-Einstein, and Bose. My paper came up. One other paper came up. The other paper that came up has the title Projectable Predicates in Analog and Simulated Systems. That's by James Mattingly and Walter Warwick. Philosophers need to get into this stuff. It's extremely interesting. So if I do nothing else today, I hope to spur your interest in the topic. Oh, look, we have some people joining us. Good. Okay. So here's what I'm going to be talking about, at least some of this stuff, right? Now, I understand and encourage interruptions, but if you want to get to the really interesting stuff, don't interrupt me too much before we get to number six, because that's sort of the heart of the talk. And what goes before is, in large part, preliminary remarks. So if we get stuck on number two, we'll never get to the heart of the talk. I'm prepared to drop the last couple of sections. That will be okay. So I'm talking about interference phenomena, and so here's an example. This is a picture of an interference pattern generated, I believe, in 1997, one of the earliest experiments demonstrating interference between two Bose-Einstein condensates at MIT. And it's rather beautiful to see those interference patterns. This is produced by absorption of light when passing through the condensates. The scale of it, the fringes are separated by, I don't know, about 10 microns, I believe, and the width of that is of the order of potentially a millimeter or a millimeter, something like that. Okay, now, when you see interference, it's natural to suppose that what's going on is a phenomenon that involves a relative phase between what doing the interfering. So here's a relative phase state, which if it were the state of the system, the combined condensate, at least in the ideal situation, would predict such an interference pattern. Now, just to explain, we have the A condensate and the B condensate with NA bosons in condensate A and NB in condensate B, and the UA is a single particle wave function, and this creates a single particle with that wave function and a single leap of VB. And this lambda is a parameter that labels the relative phase of the two condensates. So if that were the state, that's the kind of interference pattern we would expect to get, at least in the ideal situation. I'm making all kinds of idealizations here. The bosons are not interacting with each other, and so on. Okay. So,
no. Not because if they were too unequal, then they wash out the interference. The visibility of that pattern will depend on that ratio.
Okay, thank you for that remark. So I have to be assuming that they are equal enough not to wash it out. Good. Okay, so that's what we're going to be talking about. Now, what's that got to do with emergence and reduction? Well, a lot of things. So let's talk a little bit about, in general terms, about emergence and reduction. So often emergence and reduction are seen as diametrically opposed views of the same thing. It's not clear to me that's necessarily the best way of thinking. Uh-oh, you've lost them. Oh, there they are. Hi. So I guess you haven't heard anything yet. This is where we're going for you guys. I hope you can see this. Okay, so this is a plan of the talk. Can you wave to me in Western if you can hear what I'm saying? Thank you. Good. Let's go ahead then. So here was an interference pattern between two Bose-Einstein condensates. These are dilute gas condensates, prepared, I believe, in 1997. Okay, so here's what I'm going to say about, in general terms, about emergence and reduction. It seems to me that it's not always the best view of these two to think of them as diametrically opposed views of the same thing. In particular, it seems to me, at least often to be the case, that one talks about emergence as a relation that may or may not obtain between items in the world that scientists study. One talks about emergent phenomena, emergent properties, emergent behavior. Maybe I'll get around today talking even about emergent objects. On the other hand, reduction is typically, I think, seen as a relation applicable to products of the study of the world by scientists, to theories or theoretical descriptions or sciences or laws, strictly law statements, if one thinks that laws are in the world and law statements are attempts to correctly capture what's in the world. Okay, that's just a preliminary remark. I'm going to be mostly focusing on emergence as a relation that may or may not obtain between items in the world today. There will be a little remark, perhaps an important one later, on reduction as a relation between theories. But mostly we're going to be talking about emergence of properties in certain physical systems. Okay, so if we focus on emergence of properties, then what would it mean to say that a property emerges? Well, one can understand the notion probably usefully in many different ways. Here's what I'm going to say about it in general terms. I would distinguish three senses in which one could say a property is emergent. The first is synchronic emergence. I got this quote from a seminal article by Philip Anderson, or it's different, where he says, at each level of complexity, entirely new properties appear. One can think of phase transitions in which one has a complex system. Suddenly, at a phase transition, entirely new properties appear, like being liquid rather than gaseous, or being superconducting rather than not being superconducting. There's another notion of emergence I call diachronic, or perhaps better, dynamic emergence. That's the sort of thing that happens every time you cook in the kitchen or brew beer, right? You start off with a bunch of ingredients, you transform them in various ways, and at the end of the process, something emerges, which, if you're lucky, tastes good, for example. So the emergent property emerges dynamically as a result of a dynamical process in that case. Now, I don't think it's also useful to introduce another category of emergence, like elusive emergence. The basic idea here is that the properties which supposedly emerge maybe aren't real properties at all. So in some sense, nothing really emerges, although it might be convenient to talk as if something does. I gave the example of taste as an example of dynamic emergence, but if you believe Galileo, that's an example of elusive emergence. There's no such thing as taste in the world. That's an illusion. So when you cook in the kitchen and you produce something that tastes really good, there's no real taste in the world. That's just an example. I think all three, these three kinds of emergence or takes on emergence are relevant to the emergence of relative phase between Bose-Einstein condensates. Okay. I also think that one can talk about emergence of objects, and if I have time today, I'll get around to giving an example of that. In one sense, object can be said rather trivially to be emergent. One could just say that an object is emergent just in case that object possesses an emergent property. So it inherits its emergence from its properties. But I think one might also at least try to talk about what I call independent emergence, where in particular, an object could be composed wholly of basic parts of a certain kind, but not of any definite number of them, not of any definite collection of them. And it wouldn't be emergent because of its properties. It will be emergent because of something peculiar going on involving its constituents. Okay.
It's up to you. I mean, once we know the categories, then we can dispute in particular cases whether or not that would be an appropriate thing to stick in that category. I don't think it's particularly good candidate. I'll give you a better one later. I hope if I have time. Okay. So one approach to the emergence of relative phase between Bose-Einstein condensates is to appeal to spontaneous symmetry breaking. I have this quote from Anderson, which is worth reading. The essential idea is that in the so-called n-tenth infinity limit of large systems, on our own macroscopic scale, it's not only convenient but essential to realize that matter will undergo sharp singular phase transitions to states in which the microscopic primitives and even the microscopic equations of motion are in a sense violated. Now, clearly, Bose-Einstein condensates are systems that have undergone a phase transition. So one might hope that this would be a way of understanding what's going on in the emergence of phase between two Bose-Einstein condensates, which is going to yield the kind of interference pattern that we saw. Stephen Weinberg also appeals to spontaneous symmetry breaking, this time in the context of superconductors, where he says at one point a superconductor is simply a material in which electromagnetic gauge invariance is spontaneously broken. So can we understand the phenomenon of a relative phase between two Bose-Einstein condensates as an instance of spontaneous symmetry breaking? Well, what will be broken? Maybe spontaneously broken would be a U1 symmetry, phase symmetry. That's to say, initially one starts off with two one might think one started off with two condensates with no relative phase, but this phase symmetry is spontaneously broken, and lo, a particular value for the relative phase emerges. Now, in this context, a number of people have talked about analogy between this system and a Heisenberg ferromagnet, in which you have a large number, ideally an infinite number, of independent systems, independent little magnets, with spins which may or may not be oriented with respect to one another, such that they're all aligned. And if they're in an energetic state, they will typically adopt random alignments, and there won't be any magnetization. If the phase transition, somehow, they all line up. But the question is, which way do they all line up? The whole system is rotationally symmetric, and yet that rotational symmetry is spontaneously broken when the system goes into its ground state, if it does, as the temperature is reduced. Okay, now we can model this along lines that are suggested by the earlier quote from Anderson as a case in which we take the n-tenth infinity limit and we apply quantum mechanics to a system idealized as containing an infinite number of degrees of freedom, the spins of all of those little magnets. Now, if we do that, then we have a story to tell about spontaneous symmetry breaking. We can say that for a quantum mechanical system with an infinite number of degrees of freedom, the fundamental Heisenberg or Weyl form of the commutation relations have unitarily inequivalent Hilbert space representations, in which case we could perhaps understand spontaneous symmetry breaking as modeled by a selection of one of these Hilbert spaces. That's perhaps the sort of thing that's supposed to go on in the Higgs mechanism in quite different contexts, which I don't want to be distracted into talking about today, I hope. Okay, so maybe that's the way to understand what's going on when a relative phase emerges between Hilbert and Einstein condensate. Well, there are difficulties with that approach, and here are two. I don't know how seriously you want to take these difficulties, but I want to at least lay them out. First of all, think about the relative phases we're talking about here. The U1 phase of a BEC in the kind of case we're considering is specified only relative to another similar BEC. If I prepare rubidium 87 as a condensate here, and then its phase might, may or may not be well defined relative to another condensate of rubidium 87, but it's not defined apparently relative to this room or my body or the pole star or anything like that, and perhaps not even another kind of condensate formed of different sorts of atoms. Secondly, we were supposed to be making an idealization at in which n tended to infinity. Those are always tricky. It is true that the number of atoms in the BEC is large. I believe the earliest BECs contained of the order of 1,000 atoms. Now they're up to 1,000,000, maybe more for all I know. But that's still not 10 to the 23rd. It's a lot less than the number of atoms one would expect to see in a decent-sized ferromagnet. It's certainly not infinite. So is n tends to infinity idealization legitimate in this situation? I don't want to dismiss this approach, but I want to pass on to a completely different approach now, or apparently completely different approach, to see how we can still explain the interference pattern without appealing to spontaneous symmetry breaking. Okay. Even before the first interference phenomenon was actually observed, there was a paper by Jevanainen and Yu, who demonstrated numerically, and just after Castan and Delibar showed analytically, you would get an interference pattern, almost certainly, built up from successive detections of individual atoms randomly selected from a pair of overlapping BECs, even if each BEC is initially described by a Fock state corresponding to a definite number of atoms. So we drop the idea that we are in a relative phase state. Instead, we're saying, look, here's one BEC, it's prepared in a Fock state with a definite number of atoms, say NA. And here's another one, it's prepared in a Fock state with a definite number of atoms, NB. And what we do is get these two to interfere. And if we look at the results of each individual measurement on individual particles in the right sort of situation, the results of all of those measurements will indeed deliver us back an interference pattern. That's rather striking, that claim. You might need convincing, and I'll try and give you an argument that is supposed to convince you in a little while. It's rather striking because it seems like initially we don't have any connection between the two BECs. Each one is prepared perhaps independently, contains a definite number of atoms, there's no definite phase relation, and yet we get the interference, which is perhaps surprising. Okay, now here is something that Castan and Dalibar showed in their 1997 paper, that there are two different points of view on this kind of system. We can either assume that we started off with a pair of coherent states with a definite relative phase, like my first relative phase state, in which case successive measurements on atoms selected from the pair of condensates appropriately would reveal that pre-existing phase in an interference phenomenon. That was the story we started off telling. But entirely equivalently, we can assume that each condensate is initially represented by a definite Fock state with no defined relative phase. And then we trace through the same sequence of measurements, and they will progressively yield exactly the same interference pattern you'd expect from some well-defined but randomly chosen relative phase, lambda. Now, in this picture, we're thinking of successive measurements on atoms chosen from the condensates. And we're doing it in making the assumption that each measurement will collapse the state onto an eigenstate of the remaining atoms in the condensates. And those successive collapses gradually
transform the state, and the gradual transformation of the state gradually gives us a state which, from then on, delivers up the interference pattern very nicely. It's the same one. Okay. Now, at this point, you should probably be scratching your head if you haven't seen this sort of thing before, and saying, that can't fly. That's crazy. How could you start off with two completely different points of view and end up in exactly the same place? So there's an analysis that I was first introduced to by Frank Lalloway, which I find particularly elegant, which shows why this happened. So let's, from now on, don't worry about normalization anywhere, because the only thing we're concerned about is relative probability. So I'll really write down lots of states that aren't normalized. The initial example of a double pot state was something like number two, where we have NA particles in the A condensate and NB in the B condensate. And now, just to make things more interesting, we think of UA and BB as spatial wave functions. We add spin. It doesn't have to be spin. It just has to be some internal degree of freedom. So alpha is labeled an internal degree of freedom, and beta a different one. And it'll be useful to think of alpha as corresponding to spin up and beta to spin down. Now we can think what happens if we prepare two condensates, each in a definite spin, its own definite spin state, but differently oriented. And if we let them overlap. Now, the interesting thing here is that once we've introduced this spin variable, we have complete freedom to vary UA and BB however we like. They can be brought into coincidence so that they're the same, at least in a thought experiment, which is what I mean talking about. Or we could treat other sorts of situations. A natural sort of situation is where the two expand separately and come to overlap in this region here, right? So this is one scenario that we can encompass within this idealized picture. You have two condensates corresponding to two different internal spin states. They expand, they overlap in this region of space. And then what we do is make spin measurements on things in this region. And we carefully select only transverse spin measurements. So if this one is oriented, say, in the plus z direction, this one in the minus z direction, then we only make transverse spin measurements in the xy plane. And we have complete freedom of choice as to which direction in the xy plane to make measurements in. And of course, you can see that in this sort of situation, if we make a measurement in the xy plane, that measurement isn't going to discriminate between the two condensates. You won't be able to tell which one it came from, and that's exactly the sort of situation you'd expect to see interference. Okay. So I'm going to skip over a few transparencies. We can come back to them if you're interested in the discussion. It's very much up to you what you want to find interesting here today. And if you get into the technical stuff, that's fine. But if you want to stay with the more general philosophical stuff, that's equally fine. Okay. So what's the plan? Here's the analysis. We think that what's going on in the idealized experiment is that we have lots and lots of little detectors set up in the overlap region, each of which has a little box in which it may or may not detect the particle. And not only may it detect a particle in that box, if it does, it will tell you whether it's spinning up or down along a phi direction for that box. But lots of little boxes, none of them overlap, and we may or may not catch particles in each of these little boxes. And if we do, there will be a direction, maybe different directions for different boxes, it doesn't matter, such that we can also tell from the result of that measurement whether the particle is spinning up or down along that direction. Okay. So rather than thinking now of successive projective measurements, we think of just a whole bunch of simultaneous measurements within that array of boxes. And we want to know what the joint probabilities of various sequences of outcomes. Sequences not in the temporal sense anymore, but sequences in our conceptual sense. So what we do is we put the initial state in, this double box state, and we look at projectors onto particular spin states in the transverse direction, so that the first one here, for example, that one is a projector which will correspond to 1 if we get result eta 1
seeing the little detector who's centered on position R1, who's looking for spins in the phi 1 direction. All of these little detectors have the same volume, delta. None of them overlap. Okay. Now, you can see if we make the volume small enough, you're very unlikely to catch 2 particles or 17 particles. The possibility is either you catch nothing at all or you catch 1. So what we're really interested in here is just the cases where you catch 1 particle in each of these m different detectors centered on their m little boxes. And we want to know the joint probability for doing that. That's the gain. Okay. So what we hope, yeah. In this case, plus or minus 1, up or down. Exactly. Right. You might think it's making it unnecessarily complicated. Why don't we just choose all the same directions here? But in fact, it doesn't really matter. That's sort of interesting. Okay. Now, I'm not going to take you through the math. I've already jumped through some of it. If we try to calculate this thing, this is the result that we get. Okay. We get something of the following form. It's an integral over this parameter lambda. Where'd that come from? I'll tell you in a minute. Okay. Of a product of a bunch of terms, each of which looks very much like an interference term for a single wave function. We've made a couple of approximations. In later papers, Lalo actually managed to avoid making some of the approximations that were made to get to this result, but they're all justifiable in certain idealized situations. Okay, so that's the result of our joint probability. So where did that lambda come from? That's going to appear as a relative phase. We didn't feed it in at the beginning. There was no relative phase at the beginning, but now we've got a lambda. Where did it come from? Well, here. There's a very clever trick. In order to calculate this expectation value 10, essentially what you have to do is figure out where all these projectors are. And within the many particle formalism, they end up being composed out of various field operators. And if you say what all those field operators are in that expression, in terms of annihilation and creation operators, and you shove all of the, creation operators over to the left and annihilation operators over to the right, taking account of the fact that everything commutes because of the fact that these little boxes don't overlap, then you end up with an expression that eventually simplifies. And a key point is that for most choices the various parameters in here, the answer is going to be 0. In particular, in order not to get an answer of 0, you have to make sure that when you've acted on phi by all the relevant annihilation operators and over here and creation operators over there, you have particle conservation. You have as many particles going in as come out. In order to get that, or rather a very elegant way of getting that, is to use this mathematical identity. You can see that we want to make sure that the number of particles is the same. That's why we have a delta function on the right. And we just expand that delta function in terms of this identity, and that's where lambda comes from. So by this route, what is going to end up being our relative phase is introduced as the mathematical artifice to handle particle conservation in the calculation that we're trying to perform. That's where it comes from. Okay, so now let's see. This is where we were. What does that mean? Well, what we have to do is to see what happens to various different values of m. For m equals 1, we just have a single particle being detected. Single particle, does that really an interference? Well, it would if we weren't integrating over lambda here. But of course, we are integrating over lambda here, and that completely washes out the interference. So you don't get any single particle interference. That's the first step. Okay. Let's go through that again. What you would get if you weren't integrating over lambda in this expression, 13 or 14, if that's the way of rewriting it, is something which would be exactly the kind of a wave function that would correspond to 15 and would give you a relative phase lambda and would give you an interference pattern like the one that we saw. But since you're integrating over lambda, that washes out the interference pattern completely. What about two particles? What question are we going to ask? The right question to ask for two particles is, what is the conditional probability of getting a certain result, given that you got a result for the first particle? If you ask that question, then you see that the result of the first particle is giving you a definite value for eta, a definite value for R1, where you detected it, and a definite value for phi, because it was set to a particular direction. So you put all those parameters in, the effect is to multiply the distribution when you integrate over lambda by this factor. What that is doing is now telling you that the conditional probability for the second particle is not arrived at by uniform integration over lambda, but by integration over lambda with this extra factor in. That already is quite likely to give you a little bit of correlation between the first particle detection in its spin direction and the second particle detection in its spin direction. But things really become clear if you consider lots and lots of these. Now, when I say lots and lots, how many? Perhaps of the order of 100. Remember, we have a lot of these atoms to play with. We've at least got 1,000, and we might say we have 1,000,000. So loss of 100 isn't going to make too much difference. If you consider the probability distribution for the transverse spin of the m plus first particle conditional on given outcomes for the other m measurements, that becomes strongly peaked as m increases. So for large m, the probability distribution from the double Fox state coincides with that of the relative phase state. That's where the interference pattern is coming from now. So I skipped over that quite quickly. I just wanted to give you the highlights, and we can come back to some of the details if that's what you find interesting. This is what Lalloway said about this in a 2006, I think, paper. Standard quantum mechanics considers that lambda has no physical existence at the beginning of the series of measurements, and that its determination is just the result of a series of random perturbations of the system introduced by the measurement. Nevertheless, 14, that thing there, shows that all observations are totally compatible with the idea of a pre-existing value of lambda, which is perfectly well defined, but unknown, remains constant, and is only revealed instead of created by the measurement. So Lalloway is taking this line. If you believe quantum mechanics as it has been applied, there was no pre-existing value of lambda. You didn't have to appeal to spontaneous symmetry breaking to explain this. Lambda emerges dynamically as a result of these measurements. But Lalloway is also suggesting, this is so striking, maybe we shouldn't believe quantum mechanics. Maybe there's an alternative sort of hidden variable story about what's going on here, which says that lambda is real, and it was there from the beginning. I'd say he's suggesting this, not because he believes it at the end of the day. His own subsequent work gives you conclusive reasons not to disbelieve it. But he's en route to an interesting argument, which is what I want to get onto next. Okay. He considers the following Gedanken experiment. We had scenario one, where we had these two expanding and overlapping condensates. But we can play with the spatial wave functions in thought any way we like. So let's play with them this way. We have two condensates, and you know the lettering is little a and little b, and they overlap in two places. They overlap in this little region here and this huge region here. And in between, they don't overlap. Tell the experimentalists to prepare that, and I think they'll be a little upset. But in thought, we can do it, okay? Now, what we do is to make a few, again, maybe of the order of 100, transverse spin measurements in region A. Because of the correlations, it now follows that it's extraordinarily likely, if we make the right measurements in B, that we will get a particular sequence of results. The way he puts it is this. Under the influence of a few measurements of the spin of particles performing region A, a macroscopic transverse spin polarization appears in region B. So now you can see how this is related to EPR. In the Bohm EPR case, you have two entangled spin half particles, or the photon equivalent, and a measurement on one may or may not induce a definite spin in the corresponding direction on the other.
Here, we perform maybe 100 measurements of spin in the transverse direction, and that may or may not induce a definite spin in some other direction over here, some other transverse direction over here. The important point, as Lalaway sees it, however, is that this is not like the Bohm EPR thought experiment, because here, region B has this huge number of things, and they're all lined up. At least that's what they look like they are when you make a measurement. A macroscopic transverse spin polarization appears in region B. And that's rather remarkable. I mean, you just fiddle a little bit over here, apparently instantaneously without any causal transmission, a macroscopic quantity appears over there, where here and there can be arbitrarily far apart. Okay, so what does he say about it? The EPR argument can be transposed to this case, and the argument becomes stronger, mostly because the measured systems themselves are now macroscopic. Okay? I'm going to disagree with that claim. So let's see how. But first of all, let's just assure you that this claim follows from his analysis. It makes things a bit easier if the spatial wave functions have the same relative phase everywhere. We can do this in thought, even though, of course, their relative amplitudes have to vary spatially to get the spatial setup that we wanted in this figure, right? And then after about 100 measurements of transverse spin on atoms in A, there will be a certain angle phi for which every measurement of transverse phi spin on an atom in B is almost certain to yield phi spin up. Which is kind of striking. What that angle phi is depends on the emerging relative phase between the two condensates, which is completely random. If you repeat the experiment, you'll get a different emerging relative phase. But there will be some angle phi for which this is true. Okay. Here's what he concludes. We have a situation that is similar to the usual EPR situation. Measurements performed in A can determine the direction of spins in both regions A and B. If we rephrase the EPR argument to adapt it to this case, we just have to replace the words before the measurement in A by before the series of measurements in A. But all the rest of the reasoning remains exactly the same. Actually, I don't think that's true. And in my paper, I say why not. But that's a relatively minor point. I just want to skip that over that today. Since the elements of reality in B cannot appear under the effect of what's done at an arbitrary distance in region A, these elements of reality must exist even before the measurements performed in A. Since the double Fock state 3 of quantum mechanics does not contain any information on the direction of spins in B, this theory is incomplete. So I think you can get the intuition that an EPR-like argument can be run in this situation, even if it's not exactly the EPR argument. And the conclusion of that seems to be more convincing, at least to Lalaway, because the thing that you measured in B was macroscopic. Okay, so specifically, he thinks that Bohr would really be in trouble in replying to EPR in this context. What is new here is that the EPR elements of reality in B correspond to a system that's macroscopic. One can no longer invoke its microscopic character to deprive the system containing B of any physical reality, supposing that that's the kind of thing Bohr would want it to do. The system can even be at our scale, corresponds to a macroscopic magnetization that can be directly observable with a hand compass. Is it then still possible to state that it has no intrinsic physical reality? When the EPR argument is transposed to the macroscopic world, it's clear that Bohr's refutation does not apply in the form written in his article. It has to be at least modified in some way. So that he's presenting a challenge, if not to Bohr, then to anybody who wanted to sort of take Bohr's side, if only they could understand it, against EPR, okay. So I want to try to respond to that challenge, perhaps not on behalf of Bohr, but on behalf of somebody who liked some things that Bohr said and wanted to use them to provide a response, initially to EPR and now to this strengthened EPR argument. Okay, so here's what I would say on behalf of Bohr. First of all, it's a mistake to think that quantum mechanics requires a microscopic-macroscopic distinction. It doesn't. It's also a mistake to suppose that quantum mechanics presupposes a division in the world between two kinds of systems, quantum systems and classical systems. But what is true is this.
in order to apply quantum mechanics to a system S, one must describe the experimental arrangement surrounding that system classically. Doesn't mean to say it is classical, it just says how you have to describe it. And that's true, and this is the important point, irrespective of whether the system S we were talking about is microscopic or macroscopic. So the microscopic-macroscopic distinction plays no role on this view. So it can't be particularly hard for Bohr to respond just because the system in question is macroscopic. This is a quote from Bohr to try to support my reading. The necessity of discriminating in each experimental arrangement between those parts of the physical system considered which are to be treated as measuring instruments and those which constitute the objects under investigation may indeed be said to form a principal distinction, this is his stress here, between classical and quantum mechanical description of physical phenomena. Not the phenomena that have to be distinguished, it's the description that have to be distinguished. So I see this as set in the context of Bohr's radical pragmatism, according to which all ascriptions of physical reality to properties of systems are contextual. If you take them out of context, they lack significance. I put it that way rather than saying they're meaningless, because as soon as I start saying they're meaningless, everybody says, ah, well, that's a positivism. And I don't think Bohr's a positivist, at least on this reading. This is a pragmatic, not a verificationist view of meaning. In applying quantum mechanics to the BECs in Lalloway's EPR-Gedanken experiment, an ascription of macroscopic magnetization to the contents of region B lacks significance in the absence of classically described conditions external to the system of BEC. That's the point, right? So it's hard to resist the conclusion that, look, if I'm certain to find a macroscopic magnetization in region B, then it must have been there before I looked, because it's big. And we don't want to say strange things about big stuff. But on Bohr's view, that's not right. Even if it's macroscopic, the ascription of macroscopic magnetization to the contents of B lacks significance, absent some classically described condition external to the system. What kind of classically described condition? Well, you come up with a hand compass. You describe it classically. Now, it's both significant and true to say that the there is a macroscopic magnetization in region B. Now, I said this was pragmatism, but you can see how radical it is, right? It's almost, it's getting close to saying, well, that table isn't really a table until you come in the room. It's getting close to that, but it's obviously not the same thing, because this is a very special system that we're talking about here. Nevertheless, it has that flavor to it. And that might worry you. I think it has implications for reduction. This is my one remark about reduction in the paper, rested on emergence. Can classical physics be reduced to quantum physics? Many people think, sure, we haven't quite done it yet, but we're working on it. And we've got a long way already on the road. So let's see. According to classical physics, the behavior of a hand compass near region B following 100 or so measurements of transverse spin on particles in region A would warrant you in ascribing a macroscopic magnetization to the contents of region B. That's what classical physics says. Can we reduce that to quantum physics? If you take what I take to be Bohr's line here, then the statement that B contains macroscopic magnetization isn't true, or even significant outside of an appropriate context. If that's true, then there can be no such thing as a universal reduction of classical quantum physics. All you could do is reduce a specific application of classical physics to a specific application of quantum physics. But in so doing, you would have to have described the environment needed to apply quantum physics classically. And you wouldn't have reduced that bit. So you take a step backwards and do the same thing again, and you'll never be through. You'll never get a universal reduction of classical physics to quantum physics, if this is right. So I don't know if you like Bohr's response to Lalloway's thought experiment, but if you do, then you have to think about this worry about reduction. Okay. Now, I'm going to change topic a little bit, but still in the same context to throw out some more stuff that for you to chew on. That's the main point today, right? I want to come up with lots of interesting things for you to think about, and maybe when you've thought about it, you'll decide that
what I've said about these things is all wrong, but then we would make progress. Okay, so far I've been considering systems involving two dilute gas condensates and the interference phenomena that they manifest, and how to understand those, how to understand the idea that a relative phase emerges. I guess there were three approaches to that. It emerges synchronically as a result of spontaneous symmetry breaking. It emerges diachronically as a result of measurements made on the joint system. And it doesn't emerge at all, because there's no such thing as relative phase between two condensate, despite the fact that you get an interference backing when you make appropriate measurements on the combined system. Now I'm going to switch over to a different kind of condensed matter system, the general class of quantum fluids, which includes, at least in Tony Leggett's terminology, superconductors. So the example where relative phase seems to play a very important explanatory role is the example of the Josephson effect, in which you get a pair of conductors separated by a thin metal oxide junction, and then you cool everything down till it becomes superconducting. A current will flow across the junction, even in the absence of an applied voltage. That's the DC Josephson effect. And that can be explained, apparently quantum mechanically, by a field to a well-defined phase difference across the junction in the wave function representing the state of the system, in which case the current is proportional to the sine of the relative phase. Okay, so is there really a definite relative phase between two superconductors, or two superfluids in general? Or we can raise the same sort of worry about the distinction between understanding things in terms of relative phase in a relative phase state like 17, and understanding things in terms of Fock states, as in the case of 19. Now, Leggett and Soles, in an influential article, write the wave function of the system of two superfluids separated by this little junction as 17, which is a relative phase state, the way I'm using that term. Here we have n bosons, perhaps Cooper pairs, and psi L is the wave function on the left of the junction, and psi R is the wave function on the right of the junction, single particle wave function. Okay. Now, that state can be expanded in the basis of double Fock state, in which case it looks something like this for appropriate coefficient Cm. These wiggles mean I just don't care about normalization. by the way, in the preprint, I don't tell you what n is. I noticed that today, so I put it in. I hope that's what it is. Okay, so if this were the state, then we could understand the DC Josephson effect. But is that the state? Well, it seems like it's not really a double Fock state, because if we can expand that state as a superposition of double Fock state, it's certainly not a single element from that superposition. But if the state is really this, and therefore this, then what we've got is a superposition of Fock states such that there is no definite number of Cooper pairs on the left and no definite number of Cooper pairs on the right. And you can see that that might be a bit worrying if you think that Cooper pairs had better be definitely somewhere. Especially since they are charged. So Leggett, in particular, thinks that's worrying and considers this situation. So far, we've been looking at a case where we set things up to reveal or exhibit the Josephson effect by cooling a system where the conductors are already in place, separated by the narrow insulating junction, and then everything went superconducting. But let's change the scenario. We make a superconductor in Peking, and we make another one in Toronto, and we ask the question whether there's a relative phase between them. Well, it seems like there's, in principle, an experiment to settle that question, according to Leggett. What you do is just weigh them
at separate times. You weigh the two superconductors now, and you wait a while, and you weigh them again. And of course, this is ideal, so we have to worry about decoherence and all that kind of stuff, but we've handled that, at least in our Gedanken experiment. If you do that, then you would expect different results than the two different states. If you were, in a Fox state, or a mixture of Fox states, you'd expect the first time you weighed this superconductor here and that one over there, you get an answer. And then you waited a while, and you weighed them again, you get the same answer. But if you are in the superposition of Fox states, i.e. the relative phase state, which is what you appeal to explain the Josephson effect, normally, then you'd expect to get different results. You weigh them now, you weigh them tomorrow, different results. And in fact, you'd expect the number difference between them to be to differ from one case to another by an amount of the order of the square root of the number of, total number of bosons in the system. So this is a quote from Leggett and Soule. Well, actually, no, this is now just Leggett, a different paper. The experiment simply consists in weighing them at separate times. It can be arbitrarily far separated in time, so as to determine the number difference at those times, without ever making Josephson contact between them. It's completely separately prepared, and then you do this weighing measurement. If that represents the correct state, then you'd expect, then there's no reason to expect the results to agree. If, on the other hand, the correct representation is a double Fox state, like 19, or a mixture of double Fox states, then you'd expect to get the same result next time you measure them. So what's going to happen? Well, of course, this is a crazily difficult experiment. But Leggett puts his cards on the table. I can see no reason whatever to doubt that it's the latter conclusion which will be found experimental. It's going to be a double Fox state or a mixture of double Fox states. Maybe he's right. The very last part of the talk is just for fun. Okay? What if he's wrong? What if somebody did this experiment and they did get different results? They indicated, in fact, that it's really the relative phase state, not the double Fox state, that we're dealing with here. Then that would be a case, arguably, of the independent emergence of an object, of ontological emergence. The object would be the combined system. That's not true. The object will be a single one of those superfluids. And it will be composed wholly of bosons, in the superconducting case, Cooper pairs, but no definite number of them. Okay? So here's a scenario then. In Toronto, we have this thing in the lab, and it contains only bosons, but no definite number of bosons. And they have another one over in Peking. So that seems to me to be an interesting, at least candidate, for the kind of thing that metaphysicians have been arguing over for a long time, whether there could be such a thing as a vague object. Language is vague. You know, is Joe bald or not? Well, bald is a vague term. But there are a lot of metaphysicians who think the world can't be vague. The world is definitely one way or another. And yet, if in this extremely hypothetical scenario, it turned out we had an object that was made only of bosons, but of no definite number of bosons, then maybe that would be a vague object, at least. I leave that for the metaphysicians to fight over. They're interesting. Seems to me to be interesting anyway. Okay, thank you.
Suppose I have a box here with very good mirrors on the inside.
Yes.
It contains a coherent state of light.
Okay.
Would that count as a vague object because it has an indefinite number of photons?
That's an interesting example. One could argue it either way. One could argue yes, because it contains an indefinite number of photons, or no, because photons are pretty sort of derivative kinds of objects we're talking about in the context of a quantized field theory. So we shouldn't worry too much about them because they're not ontologically grounded in the first place. You could say that. That's where the case of the Cooper pairs or the atoms of helium, liquid helium seems to up the stakes a bit. Because as Leggett points out, think of them as being pretty ontologically oomphy. They have definite mass and definite charge, we think. And that's different from the photons. But I can see it being argued both ways. You could argue that we should have realized this was a problem right from the beginning as soon as we looked at coherent light. Yeah.
I think I missed something in Leggett's argument about if 17 were the real state and we repeat the measurement, we shouldn't expect the same results. If you model this as, say, von Neumann measurements, don't we expect repetition of the measurement to give the same result of what we got the first time? And you can either think of that as, you know, the measurement collapsed the state into eigenstate of the thing measured, in which case we expect the same thing. Or, you know, you can go in many worlds and you know, they're different. Yeah, results, but on every branch, the results.
That's
great.
Okay, that's an interesting potential objection. I think what he's going to say is, look, when we weigh these things, we're no longer doing something that should be modeled as a fundamental projection, because we're dealing with sort of large macroscopic objects in the context in which we think that measurement is not invasive. Now, we could argue about that, of course. So your way out is interesting. I can't remember offhand whether he considers that way out and has a response to it. I suspect he has considered it.
So what is he actually wasn't meant as an objection, he's getting my sense of it. So how is he thinking of the measurement?
Well, 17 and 18 are equivalent. So that's the state that we're in. And we have one of these things in Toronto, one's in Peking. And we look at the one in Toronto and we wait.
Okay.
And then we put it down, and then we wait a while, and we wait again. And we see if it weighs the same. That's the experiment.
But then that's no longer a classical measurement. You're saying you haven't collapsed the state into an eigenstate of mass.
Well, perhaps I have to make that assumption, yeah. So that's a substantive assumption that goes behind this argument, right? Because if it did collapse, it, you would get the same result, right? That's true.
I wonder if you could reframe the question this way. You prepare in exactly the same way many copies of this state. And then you measure each copy. You weigh each copy.
Well, you could do that.
If there's disagreement, then...
Shouldn't there be disagreement on either initial state?
If we had a mixture, that would be. Yeah.
If it's a mixture.
Yeah. It doesn't have quite the same rhetorical power. You haven't got this single object, which is an indeterminate number of component parts. I'll have to look and see if you consider that. It seems such a natural thing to say.
Yeah, I guess I'm still having trouble with this, because the state isn't an eigenstate of local particle number. And I measure it, and I get a definite result. I can only think of that in two ways. It's either I collapse the state to a definite number, or I've gone Everettian and my measurement device has gone into a superposition of reading different results.
Right.
I'm having trouble with the idea that I get a definite result, but I haven't changed.
Right.
I've started with a state that's not an eigenstate in that. I do a measurement, I get a definite result, but I haven't affected the state.
Look, it is part of Leggett's agenda to attack the usual treatment of measurement economy.
Okay.
He thinks that it's simply unreliable in certain contexts, and we should be one. But of course, saying that's part of his agenda is not really an argument yet, right? So he needs to argue for that.
You read this paper.
Thanks. There are actually several, but I think you reference. Yeah.
I didn't quite understand why Lalloway introduced spin. Because so the first half, he introduces two orthogonal spin states for his two quantum states.
Yeah.
And then he says, now suppose we measure somewhere in the xy plane.
Right.
Now we eliminate that distinguishability.
Yes.
At that stage, you know, you might say, well, had you not introduced the spin and just gone with Castet and Derrida's description,
right,
then you never have to eliminate that distinguishability.
Right.
And you just find the same results. So,
yeah.
So well, I figure, am I right to think that his introduction of spin had to do with something that comes later?
Yes.
This EPR discussion?
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
He wants to be able to play around with the spatial wavelengths in the way he wants to, and set up a situation in which his macroscopic strengthened EPR argument can be given. There's actually more stuff that goes on later. I mean, this is one paper where he's pointing out a consequence of his analysis. The analysis proceeded in subsequent papers where he investigated the possibility that seemed to be left open by this paper, that really quantum gain is incomplete, and there is some hidden variable lambda, which is progressively revealed. In later papers, he actually comes up with analogs to aspect-type experiments, which show that that loop is effectively blocked, which can set up subtle correlations of a Kassel-Horn-Shimoni-Hope variety, and show that that hidden parameter couldn't possibly explain that. So that's going to come later. And again, we need the spin to set up that kind of argument.
So maybe you could take me back to those slides. I didn't see the connection. At one point, you have an inference that if you find, you know, do the measurement on A, then you induce a fixed macroscopic magnetization for B. And I was wondering if you could take me through the math of that, because I didn't see the correlation between spin and relative phase.
Okay, let's see. So 14 is the state we start off with. And essentially, the effect of the first large number, well, not large, I can't say that, the first 100 M measurements is to move the stuff in here for M equals 1 to M out and put them into a factor changing the weighting, so it's no longer uniform. And the remaining, or the next variable then, will give you a fairly well-defined induction theory. Okay. That's not enough for you, I know. Let's see. I mean, we can simplify this. One simplification has already been made, was to set psi equal to 0. But just get that out of the way. And then we only have to worry about the different phis.
Can you remind me what psi was?
Yeah, just the relative phase between the U, A, and B, the spatial wave function.
Okay.
Okay, now let's see. What can I say to reassure you of the move from 14 to his conclusion here? 14 shows that all observations are totally compatible with the idea of a pre-existing value of lambda, which is well defined at the moment. Okay.
So that I'm fine with. It. I mean, I could have said this even if I'd never introduced any spins. I could have said
yes.
Measurements of the relative phase on the left
right.
Induce a well-defined relative phase on the right,
right.
And I'm happy with that.
Okay.
But then there's a conclusion at one point that you get a macroscopic spin state on the
right,
and I don't see the correlation between well-defined relative phase and well-defined spin.
Good. I worried a lot about this. What he's actually shown, I think, is the following. That if we consider this scenario, we make our 100 measurements over an A, and then we just guess what single transverse angle to make 100,000 measurements over B is. If we happen to guess right, then every one of those 100,000 is going to give us the same answer. That is a consequence of the analysis. Okay.
I guess that's what I don't see.
Okay. Well, let's see. You've got to get it out of here somehow. So, yeah, but once we got to the first 100, then we have transformed this uniform distribution over lambda to a highly peaked distribution. Okay, so the next one will correspond to that peak, and that'll peak things even more. And the next one will correspond to that peak, and that'll peak things even more.
Mm-hmm.
So from there on out, we're going to get the same answer every time.
But that's the same answer for measurements of the relative phase.
What we're making a measurement of is not directly the relative phase. What we're making a measurement of is the spin in the phi direction of individual atoms, one after another.
Mm.
Right? When I say one after another, ideally, that should be conceptually, not temporally. But there will be some angle, if we just got lucky, for which it will be a consequence. But after this has got sufficiently peaked, it's almost inevitable that every single individual spin measurement in region B at the phi angle will give the same answer. Now, when I first heard this, I thought, does that show that there's a macroscopic spin in B? Because one could imagine performing just a single sort of macroscopic measurement, you know, involving all of these things, Langevin gyroscopes, where you didn't do it particle by particle. Would that give you the same answer? And I tried to calculate, to hoping at that stage that the answer would be no. I didn't finish the calculation, it's too hard for me, but I suspect the answer would be yes. I'll give you a reason for suspecting this, yes.
Hang on, my confusion was a very simple one. I think I've got it resolved now.
Good.
Which was that you imagine having, you know, two wave functions with the spatial and the spin component.
Yes.
And if there's a well-defined relative phase between the spatial components, but then I project on to, I post-select, I'm getting a particular spatial profile, so finding, you know, the atoms in some mode, then that relative phase gets projected onto the spin component, and so by measuring the spin, I'm getting information about the relative phase. I mean, that's what happens early in the analysis. I guess that's the bit that I missed. And so now I think I understand why he just looks at the spin variables to find out about the relative phases.
Good.
Okay, good.
I wanted to know what your reaction to this way of thinking is, given your discussion of reference systems. It seems to me that that might be a more fruitful way of looking at what's going on in this situation, but I haven't quite seen how yet. So maybe I'll just throw that out. I'd like to talk to you about it and see if we can figure that out together. Does anybody have a question want to say anything?
No, we actually couldn't see your slides.
Oh dear. You couldn't see any of them?
So we're kind of a little bit lost.
Oh dear. That's terrible. Well, perhaps we can at least arrange to to send you the file.
It's nice to have a question.
Thank you.
So, what concerns me about general kind of problems of the noise describes is that you have a specific case where you're able to show that something looks like a photon, some condensate, and you have this thing that you can describe as a relative phase. But is this meant to be a way of describing photons and condensation in a sort of local, dynamic, stochastic picture that's completely general, or is it only for this very specific model?
That's a good question. I'm not quite sure. He's used this analysis for very specific purposes, you know, in his own work, and he seems particularly interested in the conceptual implications. For phenomena like EPR arguments and belt locality or non-locality. And I don't think, as far as I know, put it this way, to be more qualified, I haven't seen him apply this more generally. I think he thinks of it as an interesting addition to the bag of tricks that one has available if one wants to raise conceptual questions about foundation quantum mechanics. That's my take on it.
Thanks. I don't think anybody else has any questions.
Okay, well, we'll
try it anyway.
Thank you. We'll make sure that you get the slides anyway. That shouldn't be too hard. But maybe somebody can email me or someone, and then I can make sure that that shows up in somebody's inbox.
They'll all be on the website.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yes.
I had a couple of questions. One about the notion of a vague object.
Yes.
It's not very important. But I think I assume that since a vague predicate is one that one doesn't know whether the predicate applies to something, a vague object, I would assume, would mean something that one doesn't know whether the thing one is dealing with is an instance of that object. But I wasn't really sure that that's what the situation one's dealing with here, a vague object in that sense.
Okay, let's see. I think the the way to try to argue that one is dealing with a vague object is to say that for an object not to be vague, it has to have some determinate set of parts. And here's an object that doesn't have a determinate set of parts, so it's vague. So perhaps that's a different take on vagueness from the one that you suggested. And it may be that people who get all worked up about these things are, think that what you suggested is the central issue, so that what I'm suggesting is to them missing a point or raising a separate issue that might be interesting but not the one that they're focusing on. That could be true, yeah.
One might be led to suspect that almost everything is a vague object in that sense, because the list of its parts isn't quite determined.
Yes, but I mean, the typical response to that would be, I suppose, I mean, consider a cat made up of all of these sort of bits of cat. In a sense, it's a big object, a vague object, because it's not quite clear which bits make up that cat. But then one can make things precise by saying, well, forget about the cat. That's just a vagueness of language. There are various definite objects, each one of which is composed of a definite combination of cat parts. And it's just up to us which one we want to call the cat, if any. So that's a way of getting rid of the vague object cat, by precisification. But the suggestion is that with the sorts of things I'm talking about, precisification won't work.
I'm wondering whether object has any meaning at all. If you don't consider the classical world, is object a purely classical concept? And you know, so if you consider the world as being completely quantum, we'll get this problem. How do you perform a measurement?
Right. Well, there are obviously different notions of object one could be working with. There's a very abstract notion of object, where an object is just something like a potential referent of a linguistic expression, in which case, you know, square root of 2 would be an object, and so on. So presumably, in this context, we've moved to a slightly less abstract level when we're thinking about physical objects. Let's see. Often one talks when applying quantum mechanics of quantum systems, and often when one does that, one has in mind the thought that a quantum system is an object. Now, is that bad?
You're always doing that within the context of an environment.
And yes.
You said you can have environments within environments and go on forever, but ultimately you need to have that classical world from the outside to provide that reference for which you can say, this is an object, and then you can start taking in.
Yeah.
But ultimately it's the classical notions that give rise to the concept of object, and if you try to work entirely within a quantum space, it becomes meaningless to actually talk about objects. Because they only gain their meaning by virtue of
the environment. There's a slightly less radical thing one could do instead. One could say, look, we need to talk about quantum systems to apply quantum mechanics to. That's the somewhat watered down notion of object that we are stuck with. So that we haven't abandoned the notion of object. We perhaps modified the notion just as far as we had to be able to apply quantum mechanics at all.
But when we get into these issues and EPR and so on, it's that tension where we're talking about objects we'd like to within a quantum context. However, in order to do this, we have to talk about distinct objects, distinct quantum objects. And I can look at this experiment, the A and B, and I can think, well, performing the measurements is actually entangling those systems with the classical environment, and it's through that entanglement that I'm actually creating the phase.
I'm not quite sure I like that choice of words. If the environment is classical, we can't be entangling anything with it. Because to be classical is to be something which you describe classically. And if you describe something classically, entanglement is not applicable.
I guess I'm thinking of it in Jurek's sense.
Yes, right. Okay. So his notion of classical is a notion which is sort of cooked up within quantum mechanics, right?
I'm just trying to go back to thinking about one of your original questions about the equivalence of the relative phase wave representing what's happening here and the double thought state way of representing what's happening here. And just look at the slide again.
There's one or another.
Well, any of the ones with the lambda, the capital lambda that.
That's where lambda came from.
Right, so that's where lambda comes from.
Yeah.
So as you pointed out, you don't get it in the case that you have a single particle. It's something that.
Well, wait a minute. Lambda is there no matter what value of m we put into 13 and 14.
But the interface effects get washed out.
It's just that when we have a single particle, since we're integrating over all values of lambda with a uniform distribution, the interference inside here, gets washed out.
Okay.
But lambda was there from the beginning.
Right, okay, so it's going to be part of your calculation.
Yeah.
But it's going to be affecting whether you get interference patterns or not. Okay.
Well, it's hard to quite state what's going on, because to say that you don't get interference for a single particle is rather a strange thing to say, because the interference pattern is only something which is manifested when you construct a particle scale.
Right.
So when you say you don't get interference for a single particle, what you must have in mind is this scenario. We perform this experiment once, we measure a single particle. We perform the whole thing all over again, we measure a single particle. Then we look at the ensemble that's created in that way, there won't be an interference.
Okay, so one thing that I was wondering in the back of my mind is whether one of the things you pointed out in this analogy to other cases of spontaneous and tree breaking or whatever is that you take the infinite limit, right?
Right.
But here, this might be another place where your infinite limit's creeping in, right?
Yes.
Where you can definitely see if you have 100 particles to some nice degree of approximation. But if you want it perfect, do you have to take?
Well, if you think about what's going on here, we're only dealing with probability and statistics anyway. So there's no such thing as perfection. Because for any actual realization, it's going to be a finite collection, which could be anywhere as far as probabilities go. It's just very likely not to be far away from predicted interference pattern. So it's only if we go to hypothetical ensembles that we get anything like perfection anyway.
Right.
So one can't distinguish conceptually, I think, between the two interference patterns that we're talking about here, the one that would have been generated had we had a definite lambda from the beginning, and the one that's actually generated if we start off with a double clock state.
Okay. So that sounds like when you say that you're not thinking of these two pictures as being equivalent. You're thinking of the relative state picture as being a sort of approximation, which
right.
emerges from thinking right. about things the right way, which
okay.
is a double clock state.
Okay. Let me just confess that that is the way I was thinking about it originally. But since I got here, I kind of started to change my mind about that, because I encountered people who think that there are two incompatible quantum states, both of which equally are legitimately applied to the same scenario. So this might be a case of that, in which if we just change the reference system, we move from one state to the other, from the relative phase state to the double clock state, both of which might be equally legitimate when correctly applied to the very same system.
So I guess one of the ways in which that could be the case, sort of trivially, is if the approximations that we made here mean that neither of those pictures is going to be quite right, but mm-hmm. they both work to some nice degree of approximation. So one of the approximations you're making is assuming that there's no interactions going on.
Sure.
Between your...
Well, I can make approximations like that in my Gedanken experiment for free. That's okay.
Sure.
But there are approximations that Lalouet did make to get to these results, which were still set in the relatively ideal case when there's no interaction between the bosons and the
right. Yeah, that was just when you flagged, but it seems like...
Yeah. I think that his later work removed essentially all of the relevant approximations to the idealized treatment. Where the idealization now, I mean idealizing to the extent of saying that the bosons don't interact. Yeah.
Okay, then switching to the second physical example.
Yes.
That and the weighing
right.
thought experiment, that's not really a case of figuring out whether the two ways of looking at things are equivalent. It's a matter of figuring out what state you're in. Right?
That's the way to make it exist, yes.
Yeah, so when you're in a mixture, you're in a...
Right, so if Leggett's take on that is correct, what I just said about two completely equivalent ways of treating it, even within quantum mechanics, can't be right on that system.
Right, so there's going to be an experimental task of...
Well, modulo weights.
Well, yeah.
Because as I understand it, the the candidate statement, I guess, thing, it's eigenstate of NA plus NB, a superposition of different values for free. So one way to think about it is it is analogous to the EPR bone type thing, and the way to test it would be, okay, I mean, if I'm just weighing, if I do the same measurement on side, if I'm just weighing it, the statistics from that state will always can be mimicked by just a mixture of eigenstates on either side. Right? I mean, that's always going to be true. If I fix one measurement that I'm going to do, the statistics for any state will be the same as the statistics of a mixture of eigenstates and the thing I'm doing. Mm-hmm. But if I want to know the difference between it being that mixture and being a superposition, then I have to get a little more clever and do different measurements for which I can get a CHSH inequality.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it would be testable if I had my choice of different measurements on each side. I don't know physically what it would be, but the analog is going to something else, other measurement, doing spin in different directions on the EBR all the thing.
It would be a phase measurement.
A phase measurement, okay, good. And so, in principle, it's testable whether you've got that coherent superposition. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it'll be one way of realizing Adrian Kent's thought experiment where you've got superpositions of different mass distributions at mm-hmm. distance.
Mm-hmm. So, just to make sure I got you straight, you're now following up the thought that Leggett's simple suggestion won't work because of collapse things.
Right.
But there's a more complex suggestion that would work.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, good.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That would be very fun to analyze because you make the phase measurement by bringing in another boson type
right.
and say,
right.
looking for where the interference is.
Right, that's right. Yes.
All right, should we go have lunch?
Yes.
Thank you.